Do you like Wagner at all? Should you? Wagnerism is the title of an aptly girthy new study of the composer by New Yorker classical music critic Alex Ross. The book is Ross's attempt not so much to stare directly into the heart of Wagner, but to catch his reflection, or indeed his shadow, both in his contemporaries and everyone after, from civil rights pioneers to, well, Nazis.
Backshadowing is a very useful concept that the critic Michael Andre Bernstein used to talk about this problem that develops when we read history in light of what was to come, and especially when we see the history of the 19th century and early 20th century as this inevitable, irreversible march toward Hitler. There are many strands of the culture and history of that period which don't fit that model or can be distorted if we only look at it through that lens. This quantity of Wagner and what it means to be Wagnerian keeps evolving and changing as the years go by and as we go from the 19th into the early 20th century. And it's a bit ironic because we think of Wagner as such a domineering and ominously controlling figure who wants the audience to experience everything the same way, you know, according to his principles. But in fact, there's a great deal of chaos right from the start and a great deal of debate over what these works meant. And sort of this kind of multiplication of Wagner's and sort of meanings connected with Wagner. And that's really what the book is about. It's sort of this explosion of responses to this single man and his work in every imaginable direction. It's a kind of singular phenomenon, I think, in cultural history that he had such acute impact all across the arts, and those reverberations continue today. Sure, if I qualify as a full-fledged Wagnerian, you know, certainly I've been fascinated by him for a long time, but I've just always been fascinated by the effect that he has had as much as by the music itself. And I started out really not comprehending his music at all. When I was a kid, I was a very avid listener to classical music, especially the instrumental tradition, kind of Bach to Brahms, a little bit of Mahler and Sibelius there at the end. And when I first tried to listen to Wagner, I was confused. I felt uneasy. I felt slightly sick to my stomach. I was used to this very clear presentation of, you know, here's the first theme, here's the second theme, development, recapitulation. Wagner was all this kind of stream of one thing bleeding into another, and you're never quite sure where you were and where you were going. And so I had this adverse reaction and didn't come back to him for quite a while. It really wasn't until quite a bit later, when I was in my 20s and I was going to the opera regularly as a critic and experiencing Wagner in the theater, that I began to develop an appreciation for the works as masterly psychological experiences, as well as ones that are charged with all of these political questions. And so I've become steadily more appreciative as the years have gone by. But I think, you know, there's this ambivalence always has to remain. You can never sort of quite embrace Wagner wholeheartedly. And I think actually I can never really claim to have gotten to the bottom of it, you know, because every time I come back to it, it sort of means something different. And so it's this ever evolving relationship. And perhaps I'll eventually go back to loathing Wagner. I don't know. But it's always fluctuating in that way. He is German, all too German, extremely nationalist in his views throughout his life. And of course, he's an absolutely ferocious anti-Semite. And that would seem, you might think, that this would have severely limited the appeal of his music to people outside that group. And yet that wasn't the case at all. People were certainly aware of Wagner's anti-Semitism, but especially in the later 19th century, it wasn't a dominant topic in terms of how Wagner was perceived. And even Wagner's Germanness was held somewhat at arm's length. I mean, if you look at how French Wagnerians, beginning spectacularly with Baudelaire in 1861, embraced Wagner as this great avant-garde bohemian figure who represents this liberation of the consciousness and a doorway to the dream state. Wagner's Germanness really didn't enter into their thinking at all. They sort of ignored it almost completely. And then you have this very interesting phenomenon of minority groups, sort of socially marginalized groups, who embrace Wagner as a kind of vehicle to their own potential social and cultural ascent. You know, sort of they're kind of coming into their own. And what happens is that Wagner's model of reviving myth and giving it contemporary relevance is a model for how African Americans, say, can reach back to ancient myth, ancient legend in their own traditions and bring it to life. Irish nationalists sort of looked at Wagner through something of the same lens. Yeats saw Wagner as a model in that way. The Catalan Wagnerians, and of course I talk about the Jewish Wagnerians, and that's a very sort of difficult phenomenon to really encompass, because I think the Wagner's Jewish fans at the end of the 19th century were coming from several different directions. It was not monolithic at all, but you did have this astonishing fact that Theodor Herzl, at the time he was writing The Jewish State, his prophecy of the Zionist state, was regularly attending Tannhäuser at the opera in Paris and said that only on the evenings when he did not see the opera was he not inspired by his idea. In other words, that somehow witnessing the opera was integral. It impelled the development of his ideas. And that's remarkable, but it's a sign of how Wagner can leap beyond his specific context and become a model to people of all different backgrounds and traditions.
You might imagine that Wagner had already written Jewishness in Music, which is, as you say, a fiercely anti-Semitic tract, that would have been enough to put people off.
That was not an obstacle for many of them. And I think we have to sort of look at this through the lens of how it appeared to people at the time and sort of not somehow try to remove our knowledge of what happened we need to somehow sort of see this question through the eyes of people at the time without the knowledge of what was to come, without the knowledge of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. And if you remove that from the equation, you can imagine how for a lot of Jewish Wagnerians, this was more an ugly, unattractive eccentricity on his part than, you know, an absolutely dominant element of his character. And you can say they were blind, they were oblivious, but it is tricky sort of not to sort of read backward from the 20th century in terms of assessing people's motives. And many people were perfectly conscious of it and felt that almost it was a way of striking back at Wagner to appropriate his music and sort of, you know, put it to their own ends. So there are all different ways this can play out. So I think in the book, I join a number of other scholars and writers who have pushed back against the idea that, you know, any Jewish fan of Wagner is a case of Jewish self-hatred. I think that's quite.
You mentioned Larry David among that number.
Yeah, well, there's a hilarious episode of his of his show Curb Your Enthusiasm, where he's confronted by a man who thinks that, you know, whistling Wagner is an instance of self-hatred. And Larry David responds, "I do hate myself, but it has nothing to do with being Jewish." And eventually he strikes back at this man by having Wagner played under his bedroom window. So I think it's just... We should just be careful in terms of, you know, sitting in judgment on the past and sort of the motivations of people in the past, because as my colleague Adam Gopnik from The New Yorker has said, the future will sit in judgment on us in exactly the same way. And we are making all kinds of mistakes right now, you know, that we are not aware of, that the future will be utterly aghast at, you know. So that's, we need to be a little forgiving of the past sometimes.
You use this term backshadowing to refer to this. I mean, one of the things you recount, which seems kind of incredible, but I suppose if we were able to stop backshadowing, that in New York there were versions of Wagner performed in Yiddish translations in the Yiddish theater.
Yeah, there was a Yiddish translation of Parsifal, which was presented by the great Yiddish theater impresario Boris Tomaszewski. Again, in retrospect, it seems so ironic and bizarre, but it didn't strike too many people as strange at the time, because Parsifal was considered this universal story, and of course it was a well-known story before Wagner even got his hands on it, and it was something that was ripe for appropriation or simply sort of suitable gist for entertainment in the Yiddish theater in New York. In a way, in the book, I'm trying to recreate sort of Wagnerism as it unfolded, as Wagner, as he was perceived from year to year, from decade to decade. So I withhold to some extent some of the darker elements of the picture. I don't get into the German nationalism and the anti-Semitism really until the fifth and sixth chapters. And this is in a way to recreate, I suppose, some of the innocence, some of the sort of delirious fantasy of responses to Wagner early on, and then you see then I begin to emphasize more and more the anti-Semitism, the extreme chauvinism, and to sort of show how Wagner's image kept darkening and narrowing. You know, it's a story of ultimately of ideological narrowing after this initial great explosion in all different directions.
Well, one of the things that facilitates that narrowing is, you point out, there is kind of a trend towards reading Wagner alongside German military power. And at the end of the 19th century, these two ideas become quite cemented together. There begins to be something about Wagner which is associated with military might, which has something to do with the industrial scale of the way his imagination worked, I think.
Yes, I mean, this is a really interesting question. How Wagner came to be a symbol of war, of military aggression, and continues to be today. I mean, if you just look at how the Ride of the Valkyries is used constantly in the movies alongside military operations, and you know, this is most often associated with Apocalypse Now, but it goes all the way back to 1915 and to D.W. Griffith's horrible racist film, The Birth of a Nation, which uses the Ride of the Valkyries to accompany the triumphant ride of the Ku Klux Klan. So it has this racist as well as militaristic association. But yes, that really only came into play with the First World War. And before that, you had some associations of Wagner with Prussian militarism, especially around the time of the Franco-Prussian War, 1870-1871. But, you know, Wagner himself was rather ambivalent on this question of, you know, what was the German state going to be, and sort of what form would it take? And while he was such an extreme chauvinist and believed everything German to be superior to everything else on the planet, he often tended in a kind of anarchist direction and was really not such a believer in the organized state. And he became quite disenchanted with the German Empire in the last years of his life after an initial flare-up of enthusiasm in 1870-71. And he actually denounces militarism. He says that the nations, the German nation, should not have its own standing army. And so these are ideas kind of rather contrary to that you know, main line of development that you see sort of moving toward Nazi Germany. It really points in a rather different direction. And so this association with the military is something that I think is really imposed on Wagner in the 20th century. Look at the Ride of the Valkyries. In the early decades, it was often associated actually with images of powerful women, because the Valkyries are these powerful women riding through the air on their horses. And a number of feminists responded positively to that image and embraced it as a symbol of female strength. The great dancer and choreographer Loie Fuller used the Ride of the Valkyries as accompaniment to her fire dance, which is one of the founding moments of modern dance. But then early in the 20th century, you start to see the Ride of the Valkyries associated with aerial warfare, with the first aerial battles in the First World War and with armies on the march. So Wagner is I think, militarized somewhat against the grain of his own ideas and sort of the content of those works. And yet, as you point out, it fits the general feeling of power and might that's just built into the music and to the power of his orchestra. So in a way, no matter what his intentions may have been, it sort of pushes in that direction anyway, because that the music just has such visceral force.
And during the First World War, as you point out, when this kind of association was being forged, one of the people who succumbed to it was a young Adolf Hitler fighting in the First World War, who began to read Wagner in a way that chimed with his own feelings about German destiny.
Yeah. Well, the story of how Hitler came to Wagner is, I think, it's a little more complicated than many people would assume, because at first, he was just this teenager who fell in love with the music, as did so many thousands, millions of other people of his generation. It's just completely unsurprising that someone of his background would become a fanatical Wagnerian. And this was at a time when he showed no strong political views. You know, he was interested in art and wanted to be a painter and was very interested in the opera, perhaps had intentions of becoming an opera director. And so you don't see at first any political implications to his interest in Wagner. And he's politicized during the First World War. He's radicalized and he emerges as this violent anti-Semite, violent German chauvinist, and sort of leaps into politics in 1919, 1920. And Wagner is sort of very much there, and Hitler mentions Wagner as this great German figure. But what he doesn't do, which is interesting, is to really directly cite Wagner's political views, and especially his anti-Semitism. Hitler doesn't do that. Other Nazi figures did, but Hitler held back from that. And there are all different ways you could explain that, and maybe you can conclude it's of no importance ultimately, because of course, you know, Wagner had an effect on Hitler, whether he talked about the anti-Semitism or not. But for me, it's a sign that Hitler's enthusiasm for Wagner predated his leap into politics, which doesn't mean that the two aren't related, but there is sort of a little bit of a question, and I think I push I tend not to go along with people who say that Wagner was an absolutely dominant principal influence on Hitler's politics. I think there are other political influences that were more important. But indirectly, Wagner's popularization of anti-Semitism in the 19th century absolutely played a role.
You do a little work on the stab in the back, which is kind of a rallying cry for German nationalists after the First World War. And you trace that idea to Wagner or to Siegfried.
Yeah, the stab in the back became a commonplace at the end of the First World War, a metaphor for explaining why Germany lost the war after seeming to be on the verge of victory earlier in 1918. And the idea was that capitalists and very often Jews and leftists and the Social Democrats and so on had plotted behind the scenes and engineered Germany's downfall for their own interests. And the metaphor is Hagen killing Siegfried in Götterdämmerung. Sorry. And the metaphor is Hagen killing Siegfried in Götterdämmerung by throwing his spear into the hero's unprotected back. And so Wagner supplies a very convenient mythic reference there to imply that this loss in the war is sort of the latest in a long line of great German heroes being betrayed by their enemies, by the skulking dwarves, and so it's so easy for these charged mythic figures to be put to political use. And so that's very much what happens with Wagner and the stab in the back.
Your book traces Wagner's move to Bayreuth and the establishment of the ideal machine for displaying his art there. But that move and that kind of holding court in Bayreuth became a kind of machine also for processing the worst aspects of Wagner's political views.
This politicization of Bayreuth started happening in Wagner's own lifetime and more or less with his own approval. By the Bayreuther Blätter, this in-house magazine, was publishing some articles right from the start that were full of some of the worst and most extreme racist language of the day, and especially this very important shift from a religiously based or economically based anti-Semitism to this pseudoscience of absolute unalterable differences of race, ruling out the possibility of assimilation.
Because up to that point, anti-Semitism was often anti-capitalism. There was a kind of yoking together of those two things.
Yes, this is the very important shift that takes place in the nature of anti-Semitism in the 19th century from religiously based or economically based form of prejudice, the idea that that Jews are somehow a symbol of capitalism at work, to this pseudoscience of race, to this idea of absolute unalterable differences between groups that assimilation can never overcome. And this is the bridge to the eliminationist anti-Semitism of the 20th century. And so the Bayreuther Blätter and the Bayreuth Circle, as it was called, play certainly a role in that transition. And Wagner himself played a role. He examined these ideas of racial pseudoscience. He read Count Gobineau and wrote about Gobineau in his own writings. He himself remains somewhat contradictory in the end as to whether Jews would always remain separate, or whether some process of assimilation or transformation could take place. He was so often contradictory, and he sort of never delivered an absolutely clear answer on that question. But the rhetoric was threatening enough that it acquired sort of a very ominous cast in later years.
The rhetoric involved using words like Untergang, which became a kind of rallying cry.
You know, the Untergang is an ambiguous German word that means sometimes downfall, sometimes destruction. It can be a sort of spiritual process or a physical one. And Wagner used it constantly, as did many others of his generation. The whole tradition of German Romanticism sort of constantly comes back to this word, and very often has nothing to do with Jewishness or race, but Wagner gave it that ominous racial spin at the end of Jewishness in music, and so that resonance was carried forward. But I think it's you know, you can't always read racism into it every time it appears in Wagner's work, because you know he himself thought that, you know, that he should undergo this Untergang, this sort of going under, which is also a transformation. It was sort of this complicated, romantic, spiritual and philosophical process. So it doesn't always have that threatening cast.
What you suggest is that one of the main forces in bringing Wagner's anti-Semitism in alignment with his art was this Englishman called Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who had a lot of effect as a sort of Wagner propagandist.
Yeah, well, one of the ironies of the story of the Wagner family is that it sort of became less and less German as the years went by, because Wagner married Cosima Liszt originally, later Cosima von Bülow, who was half French and half Hungarian. The Wagner grandsons, Wieland and Wolfgang, of whom Hitler personally was very fond, were one quarter German. And so the sort of non-Germanness of Bayreuth is a sort of interesting aspect. And so Houston Stuart Chamberlain was a very strange, very perplexing figure who was initially a botanist, and then he turned to literature and became an enthusiastic Wagnerian and was one of the editors of the Revue Wagnerienne, which was really the birthplace of symbolism as a literary movement. And then became more and more German in his preoccupations and developed this reputation as a racial philosopher, and wrote The Foundations of the 19th Century, which was one of the great bestsellers of the day, published in 1899. And he was determined to sort of find his way into the Wagner establishment and into the Wagner family, and approached one of the other Wagner daughters before marrying Eva Wagner in 1908. And from that time on, he was resident in Bayreuth and became sort of the sage of Bayreuth pseudo philosophy and you know racial pseudoscience. And it was in that capacity that he met Hitler in 1923 and embraced Hitler as the savior of Germany in Wagnerian terms. He called Hitler a Parsifal come to redeem Germany. And, you know, all this emanating from the mind of this transplanted Englishman who just developed this almost psychotic attachment to German nationalism and German national myth.
Before the First World War, it wasn't that problematic officially to be a fan of Wagner as an avant-garde artist, and many avant-garde artists developed a great kind of sympathy with Wagner and his efforts to create a kind of the art of the future. And one of those was a Dubliner called James Joyce.
You know, Joyce, like so many people of his generation, went through this intense Wagner phase in his youth. And then he sort of backed away from it and became much more skeptical in his attitude toward Wagner. But I think it was very important early on that he had this Wagner immersion, and many others did. It was very common at the turn of the century, and it was a tradition now in the arts for progressive spirits to engage with Wagner. It had begun with Baudelaire in the 1860s and then was intensified in the 1880s and 1890s with the French symbolists. And Joyce, who was so enamored of symbolism and other fin de siècle movements in his youth, naturally, inevitably delved into Wagner as well. There's something quite fascinating that the scholar Timothy Martin has pointed out about Joyce's attachment to Wagner and his reading of Wagner's writings. So he had a copy of Wagner's writings, and he made pencil marks in the margins, so you can see what interested him. And there's one passage in which Wagner is talking about the legend of the Flying Dutchman, and he says, the cursed Dutchman who wanders the seas in search of redemption is a combination of Odysseus, Ulysses, and the Wandering Jew. And that combination is really, it seems like, the seed of Ulysses itself. And so the idea that Joyce might have come across that in his youth and that it sort of stuck in his head is quite plausible. And I think what happens in Ulysses is it's sort of Wagner turned upside down.
You'd get some nice bits of Joyceana into this book, I must say. One of them, which was quite new to me, you'll tell me about its origins. But again, it's that collection of Wagner's writings that James Joyce had made some markings in. And it's this word, is it Bewusstsein?
Bewusstsein, yeah.
I've always wondered why he was forging the conscience of his nation instead of the consciousness of his nation, and you seem to have an answer for that.
I think if you look at the English translation of Wagner's writings, you get an idea of why Joyce said conscience instead of consciousness would have seemed much more logical. That is how William Ashton Ellis translated this word Bewusstsein as conscience rather than consciousness. It's a curious phenomenon that the standard English translation remains this monumental but incredibly problematic work by Ellis, who was a eccentric figure. He was Madame Blavatsky's physician and became an ardent theosophist for a while. And he translated Wagner's writings into a language which lies somewhere between English and German, while possessing sort of the best qualities of neither of them, and so it's sort of this gibberish. I sort of made an effort to do my own translations for this book instead of using Ellis, but it's a fascinating connection, almost a sort of a clue, a giveaway, that word conscience, because you know, forging the conscience, the consciousness of the race is the Siegfried image. It's you know, Siegfried reforging his father's broken sword in the opera Siegfried, and you know, we absolutely know that this that this moment in Siegfried especially appealed so strongly to Joyce because it comes back in Ulysses and sort of the wild, absurd climax of Ulysses in a way is Stephen swinging his walking stick and striking the chandelier in the brothel in Circe, and he shouts Notung, and that's Siegfried's cry as he's forging the sword. The name of the sword is Notung, Notung, Notung. And so it's Stephen's absurd fantasy of himself as a Wagnerian hero. And now, older, Joyce is treating this as rather farcical. You know, I think it seems to be quite serious in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, but by the time of Ulysses, he is exposing Stevens and his own grandiose self-image. And it's part of Stevens' maturation that he goes beyond that and develops the friendship with Leopold Bloom, which is much more down to earth in nature, as opposed to this heroic fantasy.
You do sort of suggest, though, that even if he was above Wagner by Ulysses, Joyce maintained a kind of jealousy about him. And there's a story about when he's at a Wagner performance in Switzerland.
It was at Valkyrie, and he asked a friend of his, you know, don't you find my musical scene in Ulysses in Sirens superior to Wagner? And the friend had to answer, well, no, at which point Joyce stalked away angrily. So there was the sense of rivalry, of competition with Wagner. I think Joyce wanted to supplant Wagner as the great mythic modern storyteller of the age, and so the involvement remains very deep, even at a time when Joyce's utterances about Wagner are much more skeptical. And he's also replaying this old relationship between Wagner and Nietzsche, you know, because Nietzsche at first is wildly enthusiastic about Wagner, and then he supposedly renounces Wagner, turns against him, but remains intensely obsessed with the work right to the end. And Nietzsche loved to talk about the agon, the competition, the rivalry in ancient Greece, whether in athletics or in the arts, between usually an older dominant figure and a younger one who's rising up. And so this agon plays out, I think, again and again. Younger artists, artists of later generations, are rising, and they take on Wagner as the giant of the past who must be overcome. But yeah, I mean, when you look at Finnegan's Wake, there are hundreds of references to Wagner in Finnegan's Wake. I mean, of course, there are hundreds of references to everything you can think of in Finnegan's Wake. But you know, Wagner is an obsession, or certainly a motif, you know, right from the beginning of the book, River Run, River Rhine, you know, all the way to the end. And Tristan, the Tristan story is a huge presence in the novel. So it's a fascinating story of antagonistic obsession, I think, between Joyce and Wagner.
As we were saying, very different people from very different backgrounds took him to heart and found something that kind of nourished their own spiritual biography.
Wagner can mean many different things to many people, even those who would seem to be in a place of inferiority, according to Wagner's racial views. And in fact, on the question of black people, Wagner didn't have a lot to say. And some of the comments that you see in his diaries are actually quite sympathetic. He gets very upset with Thomas Carlyle when he's reading Thomas Carlyle, because he thinks that Carlyle is being unfair to black people in denouncing them, and a few other comments of that kind. So I think among African Americans of the later 19th, early 20th centuries, Wagner's not seen as, you know, the enemy, and he could even be seen as an ally of a sort, a model for employing myth as a way of ennobling a particular tradition, whether it's African American or any other, empowering that tradition. And Du Bois went to hear Wagner in concert and in the opera house. He was studying in Berlin in the 1890s and had a number of crucial experiences there. And he was just swept away. And there was sort of nothing obvious sort of standing in the way of this enthusiasm. It made perfect sense to him. A lot of African-Americans of that generation generally had a veneration for German culture. And they saw it as something outside of the abiding racial horror of the United States. Du Bois always said that he felt free. He felt like a free man for the first time when he was in Germany. He said he started to see white people as human, which is a remarkable comment. Even when he went to Germany in 1936, he still felt better treated than he had back home. And this, of course, was the summer of the Nazi Olympics, but he went to the Bayreuth Festival because it was finally his chance to hear Wagner at Bayreuth. And so he wrote a very crucial chapter of his book, The Souls of Black Folk, from 1903, which is one of the absolutely the founding documents of the modern American civil rights movement. I mean, Du Bois was just a gigantic figure for that movement, much more radical than Booker T. Washington and figures who had come before. But he chooses to have this one fictional story in The Souls of Black Folk called Of the Coming of John, which is about a young black man who sees a possible brighter future for himself as he goes off to school. And he goes to a concert and hears the prelude to Lohengrin and is swept away by it and is enchanted by it. And then there's a tap on his shoulder and he's being asked to leave because the white couple next to him feel uncomfortable. The story goes on to a tragic end. And so this vision of future freedom and future power that he has while listening to Wagner is ironic, entirely unfulfilled, but it lingers with him. And at the moment, at the end of the book, when he's about to be lynched by a white mob, the Wagner is still echoing in his head. And Du Bois's use of Wagner in this context is extraordinary. And I think there's something very, very personal in it for him. I think that he must have had, Du Bois must have had similar experiences of sort of envisioning a brighter future, envisioning the own potential for himself and for African Americans to overcome the agony of the American racial situation while listening to Wagner.
And it sort of underlines what we've been talking about so far, which is the way that different people could find uses for Wagner, because there in that scene at the opera, he's sitting there thinking of a future that he could develop for himself and his people. And beside him is a racist who finds this the most fantastic music and has come to hear it.
Wagner had this effect where everyone seemed together to be having these very intense experiences, and sort of the music struck so many people as it was speaking directly to them. It was sort of showing them superior heightened versions of themselves back, and you know, somehow it spoke to each person in this incredibly unique way, and yet each person walks away with completely different ideas of what this music means, and in many cases, just completely contradictory ideas, where, yes, you have the white racist sitting next to the African-American and both having this experience with Wagner. And so that's, I think, both the sort of sense of possibility and the danger, if you want to call it that, with music that has such a powerful effect and yet its ramifications are uncontrolled, you know, and just this is no limiting that sense of empowerment. You know, it can take any form whatsoever.
When Hitler rises to power and Wagner means so much to him, he immediately tries to sort of throw that switch in German life and finds that the enthusiasm around him for Wagner is not at all what he expects.
Yeah, well, this is a kind of sort of dark comedy of a sort where Hitler is sitting with audiences of other Nazi officials and underlings and finding that they are absolutely not having the same kind of ecstatic transport as he is experiencing. And some of them are falling asleep. Some of them simply aren't showing up to performances as they have been expected to. And so repeatedly, Hitler was chastising people around him, prodding them awake when they were snoring, if there were empty seats at Meistersinger at the Nuremberg party rally. He would have squads sent out to collect soldiers in bars or just simply innocent people sitting at a hotel were sort of seized and brought into the opera house. You know, he had this fantasy that as the ruler of Germany, he was going to bring art to the people, and it was going to be cheaper. Any average person should be able to go to the opera and experience the bliss of Wagner. During the war, a program developed where wounded soldiers were shipped to the Bayreuth Festival so that they could experience the supposedly healing power of Bayreuth. And there's something just of course, everything about Hitler is awful, but there's something peculiarly creepy about this exercise of trying to sort of impose his own artistic experience on so many others. And it just didn't work in a lot of cases because, you know, there was a popular culture, a kind of American-style popular culture in Nazi Germany that was heavily promoted by Goebbels. And Goebbels knew how powerful the movies were, how powerful popular music was in terms of kind of creating common feeling among the people, or simply in terms of distracting people from the developing horror of what was going on. Wagner turned out to be considerably less useful. Performances of Wagner actually declined in the Nazi era, and during the war, the gigantic, often rather pessimistic epics of Wagner were seen to be rather unsuitable. And then you had the problem of Parsifal, which was very mystical and religious, Wagner's final opera, and that created problems for Nazi ideology. So to an interesting degree, and I don't want to overstate this, but there were many aspects of Wagner that were actually problematic to the Nazis. Some people saw him as a rather suspect character, too bohemian, too decadent, sexually kind of off. And there was this rumor that he had Jewish ancestry, which was false, but nonetheless that spread. And members of the Hitler Youth in a couple of places were told to keep away from Wagner because he was an unhealthy influence. It shows the limits, actually, of art's political value. You know, no matter how much Hitler wanted Wagner to play this heroic role in Nazi culture, it never didn't quite turn out the way he wanted.
Hitler's fondness and the Nazis' eventual following of that fondness for Wagner means that his music is inextricably linked with their regime, to such an extent that in contemporary Israel, he isn't performed. It seems that it isn't in the end, despite your book makes a lot of effort to show the kind of diverse voices and diverse people who could see something in Wagner. It is, for some people, too closely associated with the Nazis and the Holocaust to even listen to.
Yeah. No, and I will make no argument whatsoever with someone who says on those grounds, or really on any other, that they refuse to listen to Wagner. I respect that absolutely. There are times in my life where I felt the same way, even though I'm not Jewish. He will always be a divisive and problematic composer. And, you know, I strenuously oppose those Wagnerians who try to say that we should set all this to the side, and the music is pure and inhabits its own sphere and has nothing to do with grubby politics and Wagner's unattractive views. And no, you cannot make that separation. Everything in Wagner is politicized. He was a completely political artist, and I do believe there are traces of his anti-Semitism in the operas themselves, in the characterization of Alberich and Beckmesser and other villains. Wagner had this effect where the music struck so many people, speaking directly to them in this incredibly unique way. Each person walks away with completely different ideas of what this music means, and in many cases, just completely contradictory ideas.
It's very interesting that this book appears at this exact moment. We are in an era where we're thinking much more carefully about the character and politics of the creator. The way Wagner has been treated in your book and through history is something of a model of that. There is something in the work that can be separated from its worst elements.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that there's something in Wagner that can be separated, some positive quantity that can be separated from the negative. I don't think that's possible. They're always bound together. Everything from the past will have some shadow behind it. And Walter Benjamin made the statement that every work of civilization cannot be separated from barbarism, and so there are dark stories behind all of these works that we treasure. And so the question is, what do we do about them? And yes, I think this long contestation with Wagner is in some ways a model for how we should go about doing this. Because, you know, since the 1850s, people have been contemplating the question, is Wagner too horrible a man to listen to his music? And yet the music has remained, and something about it compels our attention. And so we proceed in so many ways to try to make sense of the past, to learn from the past, which sometimes seems, you know, a hopeless exercise, because in my country, we are frankly teetering on the verge of a full-fledged authoritarian quasi-fascist regime. And yet for decades in the United States, the bookstores have been full of books about Nazi Germany and the war and you know, the struggle against evil. Has anything at all been learned from that engagement? Sometimes it's hard to see. Have we learned from Wagner and this story of how art and myth can be manipulated to political ends? And I wonder about that when I see all of these superhero movies and the good American accented heroes going into battle with the forces of evil. You know, has our own popular culture become the tool for, you know, American imperialism? I think absolutely yes, but it's a somewhat underexamined relationship, and the story of Wagner and Wagnerism indicates how important it is to be actively conscious of those relationships. You know, going through the story again gave me a sense, at least, that, you know, we can have deep and valuable and fruitful relationships with our problematic past without idealizing it, without expecting it to play some purely kind of redemptive and uplifting role in our ideas. And I think that's the mistake to begin with, is to sort of treat Wagner ideally as something sort of outside of the everyday human. Of course, we long for that glimpse of some other world through art, but at the other end of that relationship can be some quite ugly developments. And so, you know, that's ultimately what the story of Wagner tells us.
You've been listening to the raw edit of Culture Files conversation with Alex Ross in the context of his latest book, Wagnerism, Art and Politics in the Shadow of Music, which is out now. And don't forget, if you haven't heard it yet, the latest Culture File debate featuring Alex Ross, along with Zalia Sava, Gregory Cole and Christopher Riopelle, is on the long history of cultural cancellations. It's now available to listen to in all the usual places. For example, to pick a favourite completely at random, Spotify, where you can find it by just searching for Culture File.